Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Religions come in all forms, from passionate Pentecostals to contemplative Catholics, from Adventist and Baptist to yoga and Zoroastrianism. But can religion arise from more secular movements such as environmentalism and possibly the profession of economics? That is the question we will be addressing today. A few weeks back, we talked with Fletcher Harper, an Episcopal priest who heads up a religiously based nonprofit organization aimed at getting religious folks enthused about cleaning up the environment. Indeed, an increasing number of Christians, Jews, and folks of other faiths have spent more time recently thinking about ways to be better stewards of God's creation. In that interview, we noted that a number of secular environmental groups have been rather reluctant to engage with church groups because of the apparent religious baggage that they bring to the table, supposedly favoring faith over science. However, a number of scholars have been wondering if the secular environmental movement is starting to resemble a religion unto itself, complete with a set of beliefs to be taken on faith, as well as rituals and sacrifices that need to be made. One of those scholars is Professor Robert Nelson, a professor of environmental policy in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Independent Institute. He is a prodigious author, writing a wide range of articles, op-ed pieces, policy reports, and 8 books, including Private Neighborhoods and the Transformation of Local Government, Economics as Religion from Samuelson to Chicago and Beyond, A Burning Issue, a Case for Abolishing the U.S. Forest Service, Public Lands and Private Rights, the Failure of Scientific Management, and most recently, The New Holy Wars, Economic Religion versus Environmental Religion in Contemporary America, which won the 2010 Grand Prize of the Eric Hoffer Award, given to the best book of the year by an independent publisher. It is that latter book that we will be turning our attention to, and in specific, the issue of whether environmentalism can be considered a religion, and if so, why. I should let listeners know that Professor Nelson also published an op-ed piece on this topic that ran on Earth Day a few weeks ago. We'll link to that piece and all of Professor Nelson's books on our website, so be sure to visit. Hey, Bob, welcome to Research on Religion.
Okay, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
Hey, one thing I neglected to mention with respect to your biography is that you're not just some crackpot internet blogger going about and leveling accusations of witchcraft and sorcery against Greenpeace and other environmental groups because you drive a gas-guzzling SUV or eat beef, but you've actually paid your dues working in the area of natural resource management and served in the Department of the Interior for almost 2 decades. Is that right?
That's correct.
Well, what'd you do with the Department of Interior?
Well, I was in the office of the secretary, and that meant that we had everything in the Interior Department potentially within our scope of concern and interest. But I specialized in public land management. So I worked closely with the Bureau of Land Management and for most of that time. And the issues that I was most involved with were management of public grazing lands in the West, the management of public forests, and also the management of publicly owned coal in the West. The federal government actually owns about a third of the coal in the United States. So it was basically with a whole set of environmental issues. There were environmental issues very heavily involved in all of those areas, and also economic issues. And actually the book, the recent book that you mentioned, is ultimately can be traced to my experiences in the Interior Department, where I came to the conclusion, and this was an empirically based conclusion, just from observing the policy-making process and the workings of the Interior Department for 18 years, that much of what was going on was not a clash of economic interests or doing benefit-cost studies, but it was really a fierce values clash in American life. and that many of the actions that the Interior Department took were essentially drawing lines in terms of where the department would come down relative to competing value systems that were being expressed. And so I gradually started studying this, even though I didn't have much background. I'm trained as an economist. And as I studied it more and more, I may have used the term, you know, that these were religiously held values in a metaphorical way. But over time, I concluded that it was they literally were religions, although often secular religions. And so it was that awakening awareness that led me into writing about this subject.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing about it in about 1990, after I had been at the Interior Department about 15 years at that point. And that included my first book in this area, which was called Reaching for Heaven on Earth, The Theological Meaning of Economics. That came out in 1991. And then I had an article that was published in 1990, which was called Unoriginal Sin, The Judeo-Christian Roots of Eco-Theology.
Mm-hmm.
Those two pieces of work set the tone for a lot of my thinking and writing over the next 20 years, which I'm still doing right now. And but I should also say that I've also continued to write in more conventional policy areas, especially about land management, both public land management in the West, but also private urban management in the East and other areas where there's predominance of privately owned land.
I have to ask this. You go to the Interior Department in 1975, and you're probably going, okay, I'm do some land management here. We're about 4 or 5 years past the very first Earth Day, and you know people are thinking, yeah, we're going to do great cleaning up the environment. Your mind must have been changing through the course of the next 15 years to when you come to write about eco-theology. And then also, how did your colleagues react to your piece on eco-theology, or even the economics as religion piece? Did they kind of stare at you and say, hey, what have you been doing the last 15 years?
Yeah, there were, you know, they thought it was a somewhat eccentric departure. But, you know, there was a lot of interest in it. I mean, they recognized that it was, they didn't necessarily think that I was wrong. I mean, I have found in talking with people that they're not that surprised by the idea that economics is a religion or environmentalism is a religion. But it's more, they're more comfortable with it in terms of cocktail party conversation.
Yeah.
And it makes them somewhat, they're a lot less accustomed to the idea of actually taking these ideas seriously and writing about them, as I have now done at you know, great length,
mm-hmm.
in terms of hundreds of pages. And that seems a little eccentric to a lot of people, but on the other hand, it's a lot less eccentric now because I've been doing it for 20 years and I have been getting you know, more recognition, and I've gotten visibility in the theological community. And as economists, again, my economist colleagues are somewhat startled to see that I'm actually, you know, being reviewed in religion journals and so forth, and they don't really understand how it happened, but they're in a certain way impressed also. But when I first started it, before I had any track record, it was definitely on the unusual side. But I guess also because I continued to do more conventional policy subjects and I had a reasonably good reputation as an economist and as a policy analyst, you know, that respect carried over into whatever I was doing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's probably true. I have to ask, you know, we're talking about your policy background here, but I always like to ask my guests about their religious background, since you are talking about environmentalism as a religion and economics as a religion. The listeners might want to know, what is your religious background?
Yeah, I mean, people are somewhat surprised again, because a lot of people, because I write so much about religion, assume that I must come from a religious background. But in fact, both my parents were you know, you could call them believers in secular religion, like things like Progress. And I've never been a regular member of a, you know, an institutional, of a church or other official religious institution. Of course, it gets then to your definition of religion, and there, I mean, I would say in some ways I consider myself a very religious person, even though I don't have the convention or the standard religious affiliations, in the sense that I'm actually, you know, very absorbed with and fascinated by and committed to studying questions of meaning and orientation and how to understand the human presence in the world and so forth, which I consider to be those kinds of questions in the way I think about religion are the essence of what religion is all about.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about that, the definition of religion, because this is going to become very important if we say that environmentalism is a religion or economics is a religion. We have to know how we're categorizing this whole thing, and you've given us a little bit of an idea of what you're thinking about here, but give us perhaps a bit more specific definition of what you consider a religion to be.
Well, I should say that my definition I borrow and, or I may have to some extent developed it myself, but subsequently found that it was rather widely held in the contemporary world of theology. Most people these days who write about religion have a broader view than maybe the average person, average American would have. That is, for example, Paul Tillich considered religion to be the study of matters of ultimate concern. But broadly, I would say it's a body of thinking which addresses what I was alluding to before, questions like, you know, where do human beings come from, what's the creation story, whether it's in Genesis or in the Big Bang. The Big Bang is a religious part of a religious answer, but of a secular kind. But it also addresses questions of the relationship of human beings and nature, and what's my place in nature, and how should humans interact with nature, which is also obviously a biblical subject as well. But now many of the answers to these kinds of questions that are being developed and offered in the public arena are not coming from officially designated religions. They're coming from other sources of thinking like environmentalism. But there's competition between the two. That's one reason why I think we need to broaden the whole scope of religion, to understand that we have traditional religions but other belief systems which are performing both functionally but in terms of the questions that they try to answer are serving as new forms of religion in contemporary society. And if we don't understand that those religions are there and what they're doing, then our understanding of the whole religious picture will be seriously incomplete.
I'm going to press you on that a little bit. I think you make a very good point there when you talk about how traditional religions that we think of, be it Catholicism, Judaism, Islam, are competing with secular ideologies in the marketplace of ideas about how the world is structured. But when I write about religion, I'm oftentimes very careful to define it as a set of beliefs that includes a notion of some transcendental being, and that I think fits with the general public's conception
of what it is. Yeah, I would say that is the way a lot of the public thinks of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would call that an old-fashioned way of thinking about religion.
Well, my question,
but it's also out of touch with most. I would say the majority of theological, you know, writing and thinking of, let's say, the 20th century. And I think that it's partly because people are, you know, they're concerned. I mean, religion has a lot of connotations, and some of them for some people are, well, it's just a matter of faith. It's not a matter of logic or reason or fact. First, I think that view is entirely wrong. And that part of my thinking is that really when someone goes about their life, they're thinking about religious questions all the time. And the issue is we should be talking about religious questions and accepting and but really analyzing these questions, it may not be that religion can be subject to a definitive scientific analysis, but it can definitely be subject to an analysis that, you know, has been a main part of the Western intellectual tradition from ancient Greece. The kinds of argumentation that you would find in Plato or Aristotle, or right up even to someone like Adam Smith or Karl Marx and so forth. This is not literally science, but we're basically debating about fundamental questions that have underlying religious cores.
Yeah, I tend to divide those things like Plato and Aristotle into philosophy and Adam Smith, his writings, into the category of philosophy. Because my concern here is that to the extent that we move a transcendental being out from the definition of religion, pretty much anything could become a religion. And I'm thinking, you use the example of Marxism in your writing. And, you know, in there, I can absolutely see how that can become a religion. We'll talk about some of the characteristics of environmentalism and other things that a number of these secular ideologies share. But I also started thinking about, well, what if we broaden what else could be considered a religion based upon a more broad definition of religion? I'm thinking things about democratic capitalism. Could that be considered a religion?
I don't know that it could be considered part of a religion.
Okay.
I mean, the thing is that when you talk about religion, there is a huge variation. For when you talk about Christianity, well, you can identify that Christianity, it encompasses a very wide range of beliefs. Some of them are in contradiction to one another, but they're recognizably Christian. But we have to, you know, always keep that diversity in mind. I would say that in the modern age, the core belief has been a belief in progress, and we could call it various forms of progressive secular religion, of which Marxism would be one, but there are lots of other ones. In fact, the original American progressive movement was called the Gospel of Efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand where you're getting at, which is that if we expand the definition of religion, that's going to, you know, create some confusion for political theory and for our understanding of the relationship between religion and the state.
Yeah.
And that's one reason why I wrote an article recently, because I wanted to start addressing this question, because I knew, and I've actually been thinking about it for quite a long time, of what happens if you expand the definition of religion to include things like environmentalism, and then what does that mean about the relationship? If environmentalism is a religion, in a literal and real sense, what does that mean about the relationship of environmentalism to the state?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people want to avoid that kind of question.
Yeah, we're going to get to that question now. I still want to press you a little bit, though, on this definition of religion, because as I was reading your article from the Pace Environmental Law Review, where you detail, you go into this in much more extensive review of what religion is than you do in your book, which I really appreciate. It was really interesting for me. I started thinking about academia, too, and
right.
The different theories we have of behavior. I tend to put myself in the rational choice camp of scholarship, and, you know, I understand there's limits to this theory, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's also competing theories such as postmodern deconstructionism and different things like that. Could those be considered religions within your purview of, or your definition of what a religion is?
I wouldn't say that I would say that rational choice theory can be part of a religion, not that it's the whole religion. It doesn't address, or, you know, it's a way of thinking about behavior and the way the world works, and in that sense it has elements of a religion or can be a contributing portion of a religion, but it has to be wedded to other beliefs that address questions, some of the bigger questions, like, where do we come from,
mm-hmm.
and where are we going, and what's the course of history, and what is the meaning of history? And you can use rational choice analysis to address that question, but I don't really know that it has any. It's more a tool of analysis in that level, at that level, than it is the religion itself. But certainly, when you start thinking about, you know, that human beings, their fundamental nature, for example, is to pursue their own self-interest. If you believe that, and then you, if you take it beyond just being a convenient analytical assumption that that helps you understand some aspects of society and individual behavior, and start believing that that's an intrinsic characteristic of human existence, that people will be self-interested, and then it does take on a more religious character. It bears some resemblance to the idea of original sin in Christianity. That is, that people are, in a perfect world they would be selfless, but in fact they're self-interested and selfish, but in the same sense that original sin is not a full religion, it's just part of a religion, I would say the same thing about rational choice analysis in terms of the relationship of that kind of thinking to what would have to be a broader secular religion as a whole. And that's why Marxism, you can say Marxism is a religion because it really is a complete explanation for everything.
Yeah, it has a teleological aspect to it, that there's an end times.
Rational choice analysis doesn't really purport to be a complete explanation for everything, although it can be taken to that degree at times.
Mm-hmm. I can see where bringing up some of these weightier questions of creation and meaning and where things are going is what tends to add to the weight of what constitutes a religion in that regard.
Like, as I say, progress in a way is the core religion of the core secular religion, in the sense that, you could say we have various denominations of progress, which includes, as I said, Marxism, but also a lot of other ones. Democratic socialism or democratic capitalism could be called denominations of the religion of progress.
Well, let me take you up another level of abstraction, too. As you mentioned, progress, that's oftentimes associated with the idea of science, and there's been a tension recently posited between science and religion. Actually, it goes back several centuries, but some of these new atheists, such as Richard Dawkins, are really making a lot of hay out of the tension between religion and science, differentiating them. Would a strong adherence, though, to the notion of science or the scientific method, that it can solve or will solve all our problems, could that count as a religious faith?
Well, again, it might be part of a religious faith. It's not that just believing that science can solve all our problems is not a full religion in itself. Just like I was saying, there are aspects of Christian belief you can... the creation all the messages of the Bible but you wouldn't say one of those messages by itself is a religion. But what I do think is true is that what I call these modern religions that don't make any reference to God, or secular religions is probably a better term, they often make the claim that they're grounded in science, like Marxism did, but others as well. And I think that claim becomes part of an attempt to give them a universal validity. And the characteristic of having universal validity is an important part of religion. In the same sense that if God revealed something to us, we can be sure that it's valid and that it's true. And so in Christianity, sources of divine revelation have a particular authority. Now, in the modern secular religions, the substitute for that is the claim that it's science. And that's because we've, to some extent, substituted the scientific method as a way of understanding ultimate truth and verifying and validating belief for the divine inspiration in an earlier age. So that would be the connection. But science in itself is not necessarily at odds with religion at all. In fact, the development of the scientific method came out of Christian religion. People like Newton or Galileo or Kepler, they thought that what they were doing was basically coming to understand the mind of God as he had implanted it in nature at the creation. And so basically, modern physics was essential. It was really was called natural theology originally. And so the attempt to understand nature is an attempt really, it was originally, and I think still is implicitly, an attempt to understand God and how God thinks. It's not that God is in nature. That would be a heresy of pantheism. But God's thinking and mind and beliefs are implanted in nature. And so when we study nature, we're basically, even now, although people never talk about it this way, but even Einstein did, actually. He was one of the unusual ones in that regard. But most people don't talk about physics as a theological exercise, but it still is in a lot of ways. And when you, in fact, when you get to quantum mechanics, it's actually provoked a whole large body of writing about what the theological implications of quantum mechanics are.
Right, yeah. Well, let's go ahead and talk about environmentalism here now specifically. We've kind of covered the big basis of what religion is and your definition of it.
Yeah. And there's one more thing that I would like to point out, which is very important to my argument, which is that these secular religions that don't have a god, when you start studying them closely, and this is something that I learned, I didn't actually understand this originally when I started studying beliefs like environmentalism, but they're very closely related historically. In fact, they're derived in significant part from Christianity and Judaism to some extent also. And so what you can really do is, and this is, again, one of the reasons why I think of them as religion, you can literally trace them historically from Christianity into secular systems of belief and see that the secular systems of belief have taken Christian ideas and given them new names and remapped them and sometimes even condemned Christianity, but that ultimately they have a very, characteristic Western religious way of thinking about the world, and that Marxism is a perfect example of that. I mean, it's basically a story of a beginning and a fall into sin due to the class struggle, and the economic laws basically replace God as in terms of controlling everything that happens in the world, their omnipotence, and then it's an apocalypse, and then it's an arrival at heaven on earth. I mean, it's a virtual recreation of a Christian message in secular historical economic terminology. And so when you see Marxism that way, you have to put it in the same category as Christianity because it's basically derived from Christianity. And I think that's true of a lot of other belief systems, secular belief systems, including environmentalism. And in fact, my book, devotes quite a bit of attention to tracing the roots of environmentalism in historic Christianity. One of the sections is called Calvinism Minus God. And so when I trace the roots of at least American environmentalism, I find that those roots lie very heavily in American Protestantism, and especially Puritanism, which was, of course, the British branch of Calvinism.
Let's go ahead and do that. Trace a little bit of the American environmental movement to this. And I want to step back because as you were talking, you mentioned a number of different characteristics that these new godless religions tend to have in concert with Christianity. And you're talking about things like creation myths or eschatology, some vision of what the end times.
Or just, the very belief that history is linear.
Yeah, yeah.
Is a fundamental understanding of how the world works. But it's not necessarily, it's probably not the default position in terms of all the societies and cultures that have existed in the history of the world. In fact, it's rather special. And it's It wasn't character, recycling of history and events. Beliefs like that were very common in Greece and in other parts of the ancient world. And so the idea that, first, the idea that God reveals himself through history and that history has a direction, but it's also that history, embodies a purpose. Though that's a fundamentally Jewish and Christian and then Islamic belief, which is now carried over into Marxism, but also into all kinds of other secular beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And along the way, too, they're picking up a number of ideas like sins and repentance and different rites and rituals. Yeah,
that's what I say. In some ways, these what are called secular religions are almost remappings into a new language. It's as though in mathematics, you would transform the coordinates.
Right.
But it's still the same system, even though it's, you've had this coordinates transformation. And, the idea of equality, for example, you might say it's a modern secular idea, but actually, again, equality is not the default position in human history from other societies and cultures. It comes right from Christianity and, well, to some extent, Judaism, but it's from the idea that all humans are made in the image of God and that they're equal in that respect. And especially important even is the idea that men and women are equal in that respect. So you might talk about the role of women in modern society and say it has nothing to do with Christianity. That would just show that you don't know anything about the history of your own civilization.
Well, let's go ahead and tie this now to the environmental movement and how you tie some of different strains of thought or different individuals to this rise of ego theology. And so go ahead and give us some examples. One of the ones you start off relatively early with in your book is a guy named Aldo Leopold. Who's he and what's he all about?
Well, Aldo Leopold wrote a Sand County Almanac, which was published in 1949. Actually, before it was published, and it functions as as one of the founding documents of contemporary environmentalism. And Aldo Leopold, some people call him a saint of environmentalism. The principles are that, again, getting to what I was talking about, he's addressing the relationship between human beings and nature. And he's saying that we have to, he calls it that we need to have a land ethic. And so this is a set of moral principles that are going to guide our relationship with nature. And what he's criticizing is what you might call the economic ethic, which is that nature is a natural resource. It doesn't really... How nature is used in economics doesn't have any intrinsic moral significance other than that you should use it efficiently. And so Aldo Leopold is saying that that's an immoral way to think about nature and that nature has an intrinsic value of its own. And it doesn't have obviously doesn't have a legal right, but human beings have a moral obligation to treat nature in certain, ethically correct ways, ways that you can't get out of economic or even really most social science thinking. And but it actually, again, is more biblical, which is that the creation is God's creation, and we're not free to do as we're stewards, and God has given us dominion in the sense that we do have this unique capacity of having rational capacity to, in fact, we use that capacity to develop ethical and moral principles to guide our behavior in a way that no other animal, at least that we know of, does. But we're to be stewards of creation. And so, in a sense, Aldo Leopold is taking that biblical way of thinking about things and saying, no, God hasn't given us complete freedom to do whatever we want with nature to maximize our consumption or even as part of economic progress, we have to treat nature appropriately, and we need to be more humble and less hubristic. As the believers in progress, you know, they tended to substitute for the idea of God, the you know, that human beings had become as gods themselves, or they are playing God with the world in the way they regard it as simply a material, natural resource to be used however they want.
It's an interesting transformation that Leopold goes through, too, if I'm correct. I mean, I think in the 1920s or 30s, he was your typical land manager kind of guy.
Yeah, well, he was part of the Forest Service.
Yeah.
And the Forest Service, again, this goes back to, you know, the history of the use of land and natural resources tends to bring out these religious attitudes. The Forest Service was founded by Gifford Pinchot, who was a real progressive. He was, in a certain sense, you might even call him, at least with respect to land management, his way of thinking was somewhat socialistic, that the government was better able to do it than the private sector. But it was not that the government had better ethics or more, you know, it was that it was more efficient and that the market was trial and error. Well, the government could plan. This was, you know, in the early 20th century when a lot of people thought planning was a lot easier than it turned out to be. So anyway, Leopold came out of that tradition, and, you know, in that tradition, for example, amazingly enough, even in the area of recreation, for example, wolves were exterminated from Yellowstone Park intentionally in order to promote other wildlife populations. So it was management of nature for human purposes. And Leopold had this famous moment where I believe he had shot a wolf himself, and he looked at it, and he had all of a sudden had a sense of moral revulsion at his own action.
Mm-hmm.
And so I call it and he, in a sense, converted to what you could call an environmental religion or environmental ethic, that human beings didn't have the authority, and it was not their proper role to play God with the world as though they were gods themselves, but they had to respect higher moral principles. And so anyway, that transformation, or I would call it religious conversion, from economic religion to environmental religion occurred to him, in his case, in, you know, I'm not sure exactly, but it was not something that came out of his, it was probably in his 30s and 40s, and it gradually dawned on him, and it culminated in him writing this book, Sand County Almanac, which is a central book in the history of the environmental movement.
Yeah, I can see that born again moment in there. And again, this is where one of those aspects of religion come in. You have this born again experience where your consciousness is changed. In much way, you know, Marxism assumed that workers would all of a sudden be born again into a new way of thinking about the world.
And be a new man.
Right.
It was as though God was visiting. I mean, that's what, yeah, again, it happens. It's born again, but it's also in the millennium.
Yeah,
you know, God visits the earth, and everything after that, everything is transformed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing in Marxism after the apocalypse, and which is basically the clash between the proletariat and the capitalist class, and which is virtually out of the Book of Revelation. So anyway, so Leopold is the central figure. A similarly central figure was John Muir, but he was a generation or more earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually of the same generation as Gifford Pinchot, who I was just talking about. But Muir was a predecessor of contemporary environmentalism, whereas I would say, and of environmental religion, and Pinchot was a predecessor of contemporary economics, and maybe even Chicago economics, although Muir would be astonished to hear that.
Yeah.
So we have these divisions that have, you know, been these divisions in fundamental assumptions that have been revealed when it comes to you know, land management policies of the federal government for the last 100 or more years. And that, as I was saying at the very beginning, that's what I was seeing at the Interior Department.
Well, this really starts to change. I mean, after Leopold writes his thesis, Sam County Almanac, you know, you get the 1950s and then into the 1960s, a lot of social change.
Yeah, probably the next sort of saint would be Rachel Carson. And so she published Silent Spring in 1962. And again, it's the same message as Leopold, but with a much more kind of scientific, ultimately not so scientific, but it was presented in a more scientific way. But the message was that this idea of progress is oversold. Mm-hmm. And look at DDT. You know, when it first came out, it was regarded as a miracle drug, almost in a religious sense. It would have been a symbol of the miracle of miracles of science and progress. And so what Silent Spring does is then goes about at great length, you know, showing all the liabilities of DDT, and in fact that science, this particular application of science has led to the, you know, not the extinction of species, but in local areas, the extermination of large numbers of birds and other animals, even pets.
Mm-hmm.
And then the book goes on and launches a whole broadside against the whole role of chemicals in modern society. And again, chemicals are a symbol of modern science and progress, and so Rachel Carson is saying, well, no, actually progress is not necessarily going to lead to heaven on earth. In fact, there are some aspects of it that could even lead to hell on earth. And in fact, she foresees an epidemic of cancer. Turned out, fortunately, that she was wrong, but we didn't discover that for sure until maybe 20 or 30 years after her book. But the message is that this idea of progress is actually, that the idea that progress is going to save everybody and save the world is flawed. It's a hubristic, again, it's the idea that humans have gotten out of control and think they can play God, and they've lost touch with their own more sinful natures and the reality that they can't play God, that ultimately God's ways are somewhat inscrutable. And also, in fact, one of the themes of environmentalism is the punishments that we may suffer from our hubristic attempt to play God, which take on, you know, which are environmental calamities like rising seas and drought and pestilence and natural disasters like hurricanes. And these things are virtually biblical in character. And when you read about them in the Bible, it's actually usually because God's children have been, or the Jews, have been misbehaving. And one of the worst things they can do is to worship a false god. And then when God becomes angry, he basically directs an environmental calamity at the earth. Noah's Ark is an example.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have virtually the same environmental calamities, but in environmentalism, they're seen as arising from our false attempt and fundamentally more immoral attempt on our part to believe that we can be as gods ourselves.
You just mentioned Rachel Carson. I have to take a sidestep here. I want to come back to the issue of apocalypse, but I remember visiting the William Cody Museum in Cody, Wyoming a few years back, and I was very surprised to see an entire room devoted to Rachel Carson. And it has a very kind of strange shrine aspect to it. You know, even despite, I was there with one of the guides was there. And I said, hey, why do you have this here? We found out that DDT actually can be used in different ways, and it's not all that bad if used properly, blah, blah, blah. You don't question that. Rachel Carson is held up as you mentioned the word with Leopold, a saint. There's a pantheon of saints.
Yeah, and here's another example. David Brower, who was the executive director of the Sierra Club from the early 18 years, from the early 1950s to the late 1960s. And now Broward didn't write a seminal book, but he traveled all over the United States, and as the executive director of the Sierra Club, played an instrumental role in a lot of the major environmental controversies, really, of the second half of the 20th century. And, for example, Brower led the fight to cancel dams, and he in particular, fought to keep... There was a proposal to build a dam that would have backed some of the water into the Grand Canyon. Wouldn't have filled the Grand Canyon, but it would have, you know, the reservoir would have extended into a part of the Grand Canyon National Park.
Mm-hmm.
And so Brower fought valiantly and successfully against this idea. And one of the things that went down in history as part of that fight was he took out an advertisement in the New York Times in which he said that to back some a reservoir into the Grand Canyon would be the equivalent of desecrating the Sistine Chapel.
Mm.
And so he was, again, explicitly appealing. I mean, he wasn't saying that, he wasn't appealing to God on his part, but he was saying that to deface something like, he was in effect saying that the Grand Canyon was like a cathedral,
mm-hmm.
or it was like a God's creation, and that we had no right to tamper with it. And if we did, we would be defacing something of fundamental religious importance to ourselves and our society.
Well, I want to jump back to that apocalyptic version of things and speed up history a little bit here to the 1970s and 80s. It seems that during the 1970s and 80s, the apocalyptic version of the environmental movement really starts to take a pick up a lot of speed. And I'm thinking right after the first Earth Day, you have the Club of Rome, which I don't mean the Vatican.
That was about 1972.
Yeah.
I would say that one person after Rachel Carson, she would probably be considered to be the most important environmental writer of the 1960s. I mean, I think that the what I'm calling environmental religion, as I said, it had a lot of antecedents. Like Aldo Leopold and John Muir, and then even going back to the New England Transcendentalists and Henry David Thoreau, there's really a straight intellectual, or I would even say theological, line from Thoreau to Muir to Leopold to Carson. But then the other figure who probably had the biggest influence as a writer was Paul Ehrlich. And, he basically, he had this, he prophesied that, overpopulation was going to lead to terrible crises and famine and death and deprivation. And, within a time frame of 10 or 20 years. And
yeah, he made more specific predictions than most people did. And it reminds me of the early history of the Jehovah's Witnesses making very specific predictions about the end of the world. And everybody's, waiting up to that date and nothing happens.
Well, the Club of Rome it was a little different from Ehrlich. But it had, basically it's, what got it all the attention was they basically tried to model the future of the Earth, and part of the attraction or to the media was that they were supposedly using all these scientific methods. Goes back to the discussion we had a little bit earlier about how when you get a religion, a secular religion, what it does is it attaches scientific claims to religious, beliefs that don't have a God.
Mm-hmm.
Science, in effect, bestows its authority on these claims where God would have 500 years earlier. And so the Club of Rome, it was virtually crackpot, but it was treated, because it was presented as the result of computer modeling and the latest scientific endeavors, as though it were some kind of authoritative prescription. And, in fact, that we were, again, it was not focused on population the way... Ehrlich did, but it was focused on the idea that there was no way that the current trajectory of economic development could extend and continue into the future beyond another decade or two without exhausting the resources of the Earth and basically leading to a collapse. And, of course, this is the problem with predictions like when the Earth is going to come to an end. Or, you know, it goes all the way back to Malthus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Kind of the beginning of seeing these kind of projections made in a outside of a biblical context where they were much more familiar a long time before Malthus. So anyway, Club of Rome, of course, now we know that it didn't turn out that way.
Do you have any thoughts on the durability of some of these predictions, though? Because one thing that has always fascinated me, and I read Paul Ehrlich when I was a kid, and Rachel Carson, and all this stuff, and I got all freaked out in the early 1970s about these things.
You were worried, right?
Yeah. Oh, I was totally panicked about everything, and
That's a very Protestant. I mean, if you listen to a Protestant preacher. And I have gone to a fair number of churches and listen on the radio or televangelists and so forth. I mean, the standard repertoire is that the earth is, or everything is going to hell in a handbasket. And it's a litany of all the things that are wrong and all the trends that are bad and, how the sin is infecting, continues to infect the earth, and things are even going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a call for repentance and to be born again and for a moral transformation and with the hope that God can bring it about.
Well, it has an amazing sticking power, just like the Jehovah Witnesses at various points in time in their history predicted that the end would come about. They lost a lot of adherence after it didn't come about, but then they continued on. They were able to, make another prediction, make another prediction. Now
there's always an explanation for why the prediction didn't turn out.
And that's why I'm fascinated by Paul Ehrlich. I mean, of all the environmental scientist, he probably has made the most specific predictions. He even entered a bet with Julian Simon.
Figure, although a lot of environmentalists are a little embarrassed by him, but they certainly haven't cast him out.
Yeah, he still pulls a six-figure salary at Stanford.
Right.
I mean, I wish I was that lucky. So I don't know. Actually, one other thing before we get onto this issue that you bring up in your article about separation of church and state, which I think is a fascinating one, and I want to close with, is another interesting view of the environment that actually might be bringing the concept of God or transcendental being in. And I didn't see this much in your writing as I was reading it, but I wonder if you have any thoughts on the Gaia thesis that James Lovelock and a few other folks have contemplated, the idea that the Earth itself is a living, breathing entity. And I mean, that has almost that transcendental being aspect to it.
I mean, I haven't thought too much. Again, it's the idea that it's a natural system and it's scientific, but yet in the end it's religious and theological in nature. But with the suggestion that maybe we should be worshiping the earth. But when things like that come up, basically my interpretation that I offer, and actually in my 2000, this recent book, The New Holy Wars, I say that when environmentalists use the word earth, they often mean God. That's one of the commonest rhetorical substitutions. But there was this group, Earth First, and it said, we must honor the earth. The earth comes first. Earth should be at the center of our thoughts. And they had the Ten Commandments of Earth First, and they could virtually be, if you just substituted God for Earth, you move back 200 years in Western history and it would have all made complete sense. Why did Earth First do that? Well, there's just a lot of people who they want religion, they want meaning, it's really important to them, but for one reason or another, they're skeptical of getting it from the historical churches of Christianity. Maybe they, they're put off by wars or dogmatism or self-interested behavior or, you know, scandals within the church. And so they don't want to, they're looking to get their sense of religion and meaning in a way that doesn't require them to participate or necessarily even listen to, you know, the historic institutional representatives of religion in Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
But what they end up doing in many cases is, you know, recreating the messages of those institutions, but just in a new vocabulary. And as I say, so Earth, you know, God becomes Earth in environmental religion. In Marxism, God becomes the law, you know, the economic laws of history. And so, you know, but again, what it shows in some ways, it could be, you know, if you were a Christian, you could have a very ambivalent attitude about all this. I mean, one way of looking at it would be saying that these, you know, truths of Christianity are so fundamental that even when people think they're rejecting Christianity, they basically just come back to the same truth.
Mm-hmm.
And which would be one strong reason to believe that they must be really true if they have such an incredible hold on people that even people who denounce the historic churches still want to believe the same things. And or even you mentioned Dawkins. You know, there's a certain element of Dawkins that he comes across as an evangelical preacher.
Mm-hmm.
He behaves like a preacher. Is you know he's out to convert the world
yeah.
to his point of view. But anyway, you can find these substitutions all over the place. Let's say the, you know, Noah's Ark becomes the Endangered Species Act and so forth.
Mm-hmm. You just talked about evangelization here, and this is what I want to close up with, because in your PACE Environmental Law Review article, you talk about proselytization and using the state or the government as proselytization. And you make a very interesting argument at the end about the separation of church and state, saying that, hey, you know, we don't allow Catholics to go into, or Catholic priests to go into public school and convert kids to Catholicism. And if environmentalism is a religion, maybe we should be rethinking some of our policy here.
Right.
Give us some examples of different topic areas where this might apply to, and what's your argument about the separation of church and state might be with respect to environmentalism?
Well, I think that, yeah, the one that you just mentioned is the most compelling one, which is education. And I do have a solution. You know, the United States is somewhat unusual in its attempt to separate church and state and education and, you know, public education and religion in the way it does. In a lot of other countries, the government provides support for religious schools. And I think that the conclusion of my argument in this law review piece that you mentioned is that we should do the same thing in the United States. It's not that there's anything wrong with teaching environmental religion, but it's what the problem is when environmental religion is privileged relative to other forms of religion. And it's kind of ironic that that the religions being discriminated against here are the old historic religions of the Christian tradition, which are not allowed to come into public schools and proselytize in the same way as environmental religion is proselytized in these schools. And so my solution, though, is not to get rid of the proselytizing, but to make it, put it on an equal basis. So, for example, I think we should allow, you know, we should allow Christian charter schools. And then we could have environmental charter schools, and we can have Muslim charter schools and Jewish charter schools. And that way all religions will be on an equal basis, and it will essentially it will then be the choice of the parents. But now there's a huge financial and many other incentives to send your children to public school, where you're selectively given a religious education rather than it being, you know, the choice of the parents. But to get to some other areas, it's quite clear, for example, that wilderness areas are cathedrals. They're like churches. I mean, they're basically places where environmentalists go to basically, they write themselves about the tremendous sense of spiritual inspiration in being in a wilderness and being in the wild. And if you trace that back to someone like John Muir, Muir makes it explicit why it's so spiritually inspiring to be in the wilderness, because he's writing 100 years ago, and so he doesn't have to be quite as concerned to maintain a secular, non-religious appearance. So his writing is filled with God, with explicit references to God. And so for Muir, who was the founder of the Sierra Club, going into the wilderness is the, is the means of encountering God's presence. Not literally, but again, God's artwork or God's handiwork is found in nature, and it's in that sense you're, coming closer to God and experiencing His message and wisdom. I think, that again, the language has changed now so that people, instead of talking like Muir did explicitly about encountering God's handiwork in nature, in the creation, contemporary environmentalists talk about spiritual inspiration with no mention of God, but feeling this spiritual inspiration in the presence of wild areas and in wilderness. So that it's like going to, in that sense, going to the wilderness is like going to a church, Notre Dame or something like that. Now, how would we have an official set of government cathedrals? Is what you could call the National Wilderness System, which encompasses over 100 million acres. That's basically larger than the state of California. And
a lot of it's out here in the West by me.
The what?
And a lot of it's out here in the West by me.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, so why? I'm not saying actually that we shouldn't have wildernesses. I'm saying, though, that they should be treated on the same basis as a church. And that is, so they should be private, actually. And they should be organized. The system of wild areas should be organized privately. The government should not be, in effect, creating a system of churches. And so that's one of the issues that I address in this law review, environmental law review article. I also talk about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. If you look at the value of the oil and the gas in the refuge, it's something like, it's somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion worth of petroleum resource, and depending on the price of oil and so forth. Now, if you look at it in any kind of conventional, pragmatic sense, there's no environmental value in ANWR that could even remotely, by orders of magnitude less in terms of, if you try to evaluate it in just pragmatic terms. And so why does, has the environmental movement made the protection and preservation and exclusion of the human presence from ANWR such a focal point of its, its religious life, if you want to call it that? Well, again, it's a symbol. ANWR is a symbol of nature and of nature untouched by human hand. That's how it's described in environmental writing. So it's still, you could say it's still the creation, as it was originally created by God. And there are fewer and fewer such places left on Earth. And so we have a moral obligation not to interfere with it or to impose a human presence in this area, because it's a religious choice, not a matter of any pragmatic question of caribou benefits. Or we're making a statement in favor of our devotion to learning about and knowing about and experiencing God in a purely wild setting.
Well, how would you answer an objection to some of your policy prescriptions dealing with ANWR or some of these other federally held lands that, well, if we privatize this, yes, we might be desecrating a church, but also what about the future generations? Isn't the market system too short-sighted that they would just plunder and pillage all of this and we wouldn't have this for future generations? Shouldn't we have the government step in and manage that?
Well, we could. You know, I think, first of all, that the private management in many cases has been, more preservation-oriented. Of course, it tends to be by rich people. But it's not necessarily the case that the government is particularly foresighted. In fact, if you look at the incentives in the private sector and then the incentives in politics, the incentives in politics are more short run. That is, you want to get the benefits now while you're in office, and you're not going to be in office in 10 years, so you don't even have to really worry about 10 years from now. But I think, that the, I'm not saying that we shouldn't act to conserve or protect or preserve. You know, I think, for example, Central Park is a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I wouldn't call Central Park a religious monument in the way that ANWR is. Or the way that it's kind of a town gathering place and a mall, but yeah, it's a difficult question. And one of the things that I certainly want to say is I have no objection to people having opinions as environmentalists about how we should manage things. In fact, in many areas, I'm quite sympathetic to the idea that we have no right or we shouldn't be pillaging or desecrating or damaging the earth. But it's when that, and so the expression of a belief about how the earth should be treated is not anything that I would have any problem with. And even wherever it comes from, whether it comes from a Christian reading of the Bible, or if it comes from what environmentalists consider to be ecological science. So my objection is not as broad as some people might think it would be. It's only when government actually starts behaving in a church-like way.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel as though we need to think about this question as how to respond a lot more carefully than we have. And I think that, in effect, the way we've dealt with these kinds of questions has been, we privileged secular religion in a certain sense. We said secular religion can become entwined with the state to the degree that the state almost becomes a form of the part of the church apparatus of the secular religion. But yet Christianity can't do the same thing. And so it's a form of religious discrimination, but we need to be, it's very fact specific where the government is overstepping the bounds in kind of officially establishing a secular religion as a state religion. And so in this Law Review article and in my thinking in general, I try to lay out some grounds for how we would think about that. I mean, another area would be organic food. If the agriculture department certifies organic food, and so you could say, well, that's as though the government were certifying kosher food or something mm-hmm. like that. But it depends. I mean, some people say that kosher food in 2,000 years ago was a public health measure. And to the extent that you could, demonstrate that eating organic food was not just a religious ritual, as part of environmental religion, but let's say if you could demonstrate that it had public health benefits or that it had transportation benefits or something like that, then if you can show those, then you don't face an issue of church and state. You only face this issue of church and state if it turns out that eating organic food is itself almost exclusively a religious ritual, and there's no other way really to understand it or justify it. And if that were the case, then you'd have to ask, well, why should the Agriculture Department bring the government into that function in an official way when it would never do the same thing if it was, say, dealing with Christianity or Judaism in their traditional forms?
Well, that is an idea and thought to chew on for a while. We are running short on time here, and I will let folks think about that. And you can read a lot more about this in Bob Nelson's new book, The New Holy Wars, as well as his PACE Environmental Law Review article. And we'll refer you back to those spots.
And about 20 years of others, right?
And we'll put that all up on our website. So make sure that you visit it to see what Bob Nelson is writing about. And Bob, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.